BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio. Good evening. We're broadcasting from Dalek Studios in the heart of Bristol, right by Queen Square. This programme is sponsored by The Converging World, an organisation that aims to create a world where everyone has equal access to resources while minimising their impact on the planet. Matt Heap interviews our guest in the studio this week, Katie Alcott from Frank Water. There's another chapter from Tony Gosling's History of the Theatre in Bristol. Malcolm Greaves reads an abridged extract from Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. Jeff Sparks is back in the fold with us for his weekly slot of What's On and is going to read us two of his poems. But now over to Matt Heap for a report on Starbucks that appeared in The Big Issue this week.
When is a coffee shop not a coffee shop? When Starbucks comes to town? This is an article from the Big Issue, and it talks about how Starbucks have flouted local planning laws in Brighton and Hove City Council. Step into a Starbucks coffee shop and you immediately know that you're in a special place. Come for great coffee or just to relax and have a think. Whatever your reason, Starbucks is your place. So states the UK website. Or is it? When Starbucks took over a former bookstore on St James Street in Kemp Town, Brighton, a quirky area of residential and independent traders, there was a local outcry from residents and traders. Letters of objection, 427 in total, were sent to the council, supported by an online and ever-growing Facebook campaign of 1,800 signatures protesting against its opening. Added to this is the fact that the local planning policy states that the street should have a predominance of A1 units and that there are 17 other cafes on and adjoining the streets already. A1 regulations limit a business to retail use, whereas A3 extends that use to incorporate cafes. Brighton and Hove City Council denied the coffee chain planning permission for A3 use, yet Starbucks opened a month ago, refitting the bookstore as a cafe. Weekly demonstrations have been taking place outside Starbucks since its opening a month ago. What our streets look like and the future of independent businesses is key to the long-term future of our neighbourhood. Caring about this is as important as caring about the environment and other social issues. Starbucks is known for employing a business practice known as cannibalisation, where sister stores open to compete with and feed on each other's customers, inevitably forcing local traders out. There are five other branches in the city, including another branch only a few hundred metres away. A company spokesperson declined to comment on this practice. Further criticisms of lack of support of fair trade coffee, homogenisation of areas and inevitable hiked up commercial rents have also been directed at the company. Rents are set in accordance with what the market is prepared to pay. And in the case of Starbucks, price is no object. The local planning authority is listening, though. The actual use of Starbucks may seem to be a straightforward coffee shop to residents. But unfortunately, national planning legislation and case law in respect of such uses is complicated. We need to establish whether a breach of planning control has actually taken place. Starbucks states that it is planning to appeal the council's decision to deny A3 cafe use, and in the meantime, they continue trading under A1 retail use. It opened its first UK store in 1998, and 10 years later, there are around 650 coffee houses nationwide, with plans for another 100 to open up by the end of this year. 14 new jobs plus donations to a local hospital are ways in which the company has sought to win local approval. Yet Tim Hume, owner of the independent coffee house Red Roaster, is not worried by the street's new addition. If we think Starbucks is better than us, then we don't deserve to exist. We have that individual touch that they just don't have.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our guest in the studio this week is Katie Alcott from Frank Water. Hello, Katie.
Hi.
Where is Frank Water based? Is that purely Bristol or is it nationwide?
Frank Water, the company itself, is based in Bristol. But we do ship the water pretty much nationwide, although 80% of our stockists are within the southwest, and that's mainly sort of Bristol and Bath area. Only 20% are sort of nationwide, and we do not sort of ship further than Manchester unless it's by a full pallet, because we just don't think that's necessary.
Okay, so 80% of your bottled water is delivered to what we'd call the southwest, Cornwall, Devon, Wiltshire, Somerset, Gloucester.
Yeah.
Okay, and then 20% goes further afield, maybe even as far as Scotland.
No, we don't. We don't.
Right.
We don't have any stockists in Scotland. Actually, we don't have any stockists north of Manchester, but there would be a possibility that we may ship that far if it was a big order, if it was worthwhile the trip of the water going up that far. But generally, we encourage people to buy local water. So in most situations, I'd say that's not encouraged. We wouldn't encourage them to buy Frank Water.
Okay, so you're delivering locally, and the water is sourced locally. Where does the water come from?
The water comes from a family-run artesian spring in Devon, quite near Barnstable, but in the countryside, sort of middle of nowhere, very hard to find. And it's a beautiful farm, family-run, brother and sister who have diversified from farming and set up this spring. It's an artesian spring, as I mentioned, which is a very natural spring. So the water rises to the surface on its own. We haven't put in a borehole, and we're not sucking water out of the water table. We capture it at the surface.
Is the farm or the surrounding land, is it organically farmed, or is there use of fertilisers, pesticides in the surrounding land?
It's not specifically organic. A lot of the area is organic, but not all of it. Mm. But this water has filtered down through the ground over thousands of years. So generally, you know, gets rid of all of that. And also we do test the water daily, and no water leaves the site before it's been cleared of any excessive nitrates or anything that might contaminate it.
So it gets all the proper legal testing that any other water would do, any other bottle of water. Is it hard or soft?
Crikey. Well, that's a question. I have to say, I don't know.
Okay. So it's pretty tasty water, though. You're competing in a very competitive marketplace, bottled water. What would you say you offered people that other bottled water companies don't in such a competitive marketplace?
I would say, number one, we offer a local water in this area. There are only another sort of two local springs that specifically market in this in the Bristol area and the southwest. And we have the edge of being a social enterprise. Frank Water is a not-for-profit social enterprise. We donate all of our profits to clean water projects in developing countries. So for every litre of Frank that you buy, it funds 200 litres at our projects, which are currently based in India.
Okay, we'll talk about those projects later on. They sound very interesting. So how much does it cost to buy one of these bottles?
It depends on where you're buying the water from, but generally it would be to the consumer between sort of 59p to £1.20 maybe for a 500ml, that's half a litre bottle. And those prices vary so much according to the outlet. We sell it to those outlets at exactly the same price, and they choose to put obviously their overhead on top of that to cover their their expenses, which is fair enough. Obviously, some places have higher expenses than others.
Okay, I've got £2 in my pocket. That should cover it. I live in Easton. I'd like to go and buy this bottle of water every day. Where would my nearest kind of outlet be?
In Easton, I'd say probably the Better Food Company in St Woburgs.
The bottom of Ashley Hill?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I know the one, yeah. Okay.
Or Radford Mill Farm Shop, just round the corner.
Okay, so for those people who live in St Woburgs, Easton, St Paul's, it's the Better Food Company at the bottom of Ashley Hill. Okay, you can go and get your water there. How about if I lived in the south of the city?
South of the city, we don't have that many stockists in Bedminster or Southville as such, but there's the Olive Shed.
The Olive Shed, good. Yeah, that would be presumably fairly easy to get to from the south. Okay, if I was a Cliftonite, where would I get this water from?
There's Fresh and Wild, Primrose Cafe in Clifton, Wild Oats, numerous other outlets, but that's
okay. Okay, so let's talk a bit more about the projects. First of all, when did Frank Water begin? Because I've noticed that other bottled water companies seem to have jumped onto the bandwagon. I won't mention them specifically, but two big French manufacturers of water, bottled water, certainly now, I'm sure, offer for every so many pence you spend on your water, they will spend that on a project in Africa or India on delivering water, clean water. So how long have you been offering that?
We launched in 2005, early 2005. And yeah, there's certainly been an influx of people picking up on the idea and seeing that it's a good idea. And we've always very much encouraged that. It's great. I mean, there's such a big issue out there. The reason we exist is to fund our projects. And bottled water for us is just a vehicle in order to do that. But the projects, the end product is what we're all about, rather than the bottled water. If there was another way of doing it, we would. And there are other ways that we do fund the projects.
So people have a choice then. They can either buy bottled water, the Frank bottled water, and we've discussed where they can get that in Bristol. But they can also donate directly, am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. We, alongside the social enterprise business that we have, we also have a registered charity, Frank Water Projects, and that's a fully fledged charity registered, and you can directly donate to that via our website, which is frankwater.com.
Okay. So people have the details. We'll perhaps reiterate those at the end of the interview, as the details to give directly to Frank Water. Let's talk about the projects. Where's this money going?
The projects are based in South India at the moment, in Andhra Pradesh in the southwest. It's an area that is very rural, very little tourism. And mainly the villages that we work in, it's very much subsistence farming, so there's very little kind of income other than sort of doing their own living. And the projects are very specific, very technology driven. What we're trying to do is work with water that already exists, so we're not about digging boreholes and putting in hand pumps, because that's not a sustainable vision for the future. We work with technologies that involve filtering the water so that we can recycle water. That's basically what we're doing in India, very similar to the sort of tap water system over in the UK, but done on a sort of local village level.
So you're taking water that already exists and you're purifying it?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you adding things like fluoride?
No, we're not. And actually, in this area of India, fluoride is a massive issue. It actually naturally occurs in the ground, in the rock. At 10 times higher than is allowed or suggested. So we're actually starting to work with a new sort of technology, which is called reverse osmosis. Again, it's been developed specifically in India to be sustainable and use very little energy. And that actually removes the fluoride from the water, which is
There's an irony there, isn't there? Because in this country, of course, it is. Am I right? It's added.
Not in every county, just in specific counties within the UK, it is added to the water. Yeah, but at a rate, you know, a level that is acceptable.
So let me get this right. It's added in some parts of this country because it's good for the teeth. Is that right?
That's what is stated.
Yeah. So it's taken out in India because it's at 10 times, you said, the normal level. So what would happen to somebody who spent a whole lifetime drinking this water with loads and loads of fluoride? How would it manifest itself physically?
We just watched a DVD a couple of weeks ago, actually, of exactly that. Our partner NGO in India, we're trying to sort of encourage us to start funding these new projects as well, which are very similar to our old ones. They just have the RO filter in as well. And it was shocking. I mean, we were looking at a picture of a 30-year-old man who looked like he was 12. His joints were swollen. His legs were deformed. He couldn't walk. He had to kind of move himself on his hands, which even those were sort of stunted. And basically the fluoride grows on the joints and affects the joints and the bone formation. Mm. It's causing... I mean, it has for years caused massive issues, but these are the first sort of projects that are starting to sort of deal with that and look at that specifically. So
have the projects run for long enough for you to be able to say, yes, we've got some real success stories here?
Yeah, we've got sort of four projects installed at the moment, and we've got another four projects going in the next 3 months. Now we're a charity, we're starting to put more and more projects in as well through direct donations rather than just through the social enterprise activities. We're seeing massive developments in India, and it's great to go back every time we go back.
Plenty of success on these projects. I think we need to give the contact details once more so that people know where to send money, either directly or by buying the water. So if they want to give money directly, can you give us a phone number, a website?
Yep, our office number is 011 73 700 999, and our website is frankwater.com.
Okay, and we've discussed where to buy the water once again. Give us four of the outlets to buy the water. Fresh and Wild.
Fresh and Wild, the Better Food Company, Wild Oats, the Olive Shed, and numerous other stockists, which are listed on our website.
Katie, thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
And now for some music, Foxborough, Hot Tubs and Mother Mary.
Take a walk.
that was Foxborough Hot Tubs with Mother Mary.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our feature this week from our reporter Lisa Braden is an interview with William Alpas, a practitioner of old-style acupuncture incorporating Chinese astrology.
I'm Lisa Braden from Dialect Radio, and I'm here in Charlotte Street in the house clinic with William Alpas, who is an acupuncturist. Hello.
Hello.
Would you like to tell us a bit about what you do and what your medicine's based on?
Yep. I do acupuncture, which is a very old style of medicine, which has been around for around 5,000 years, looking very much at one's constitutional energies. So when I say this, it means that when you're born, you have certain influence or sphere of things happening from the position of the planets, which makes up your constitutional energies and gives you certain strengths and weaknesses in life. Now, with this style of acupuncture, it means that we can treat you on a much long-term basis and look much deeper into what's going on into various aspects of your psyche, emotional health and physical health.
So going back to, you say, problems you're born with, so you could just, you're not aware of this, it's subconscious, subliminal?
Oh yeah, totally, yeah, totally.
Right, okay. So give me an example.
So someone born in a year ending 6, for example, is generally conceived as being a very out there, very warm person. Now in the short term, and the long term, they need to find a way to balance that out. So it's, the image is like a distillery, like the image is finding something very pure and still within their lives. Now, they can either find that in the short term by doing things like sleeping lots, switching themselves off, or in the long term, they can do that through meditation, various energy techniques, which will be much healthier for them in the future. So you can really ascertain which direction someone needs to go in life, and with acupuncture, help to balance that out, thus maintaining health into the future for them.
So what kind of problems people born with a 6 in their birth date, what would they come to you with?
Generally, 6 is to do with a lot of psycho problems. Well, there's not been any research done on this area
Problems. Right, could you go into that a little bit further?
So it's sort of mental, emotional type problems one would expect, possibly.
Right. And so you take a view of their body, take their pulse, or what do you do upon first assessment?
Yeah, so you look at their date of birth, the year, month, day, hour they're born, and then you ascertain a sort of a balance of energies which will be in their chart and should be manifesting in them. And then in the first meeting, you do a full case history and really get to the nuts and bolts of what's going on and really what makes that person tick. And then you start to go in and feeling the Chinese pulse. This is different to the Western version of the pulse. And this, you can really feel the quality and quantity of energy in each of the 12 internal organs. And this is really where the beauty of acupuncture is. You can really, really feel very deeply what's going on with someone and really how the organs are functioning.
Could you tell me the 12 major organs?
So 12 major organs from a Chinese perspective are small intestine, heart, pericardium, triple heater, spleen, stomach, lung, colon, bladder, kidneys, and liver and gallbladder.
What's the triple heater?
Triple heater is the only organ which doesn't exist in Western medicine, as roughly can be described as in three heaters which exist in the body, or three stoves which exist, which help balance and regulate warmth and water in the body.
Right.
And it's a sort of a functioning of all the organs as well. And it's very much to do with our relationship with the outside world and how we're perceived by other people, and to do with our aura and what we put out into the world.
Is it a bit like the hypothalamus, sort of regulating things?
A little bit more behind the scenes, though, yeah.
Right, okay. So when you take someone's when you take someone's pulse and it's racing, what do you deduce from that?
You deduce that there's either too much heat in the body, creating a very fast pulse, mm-hmm. or they're very active, being out there too much, you're drinking lots of coffee, having too much fun, too much good times, or not enough sleep, conversely.
I don't like the way you're looking at me when you say that. Right, yes.
So you essentially want to help calm that person down. So you do points which are very calming, help take the energy to the inside of the body, into the deeper organs of the body, and really look at their astrology chart and is that coming from their astrology chart, or is that coming from the energies around them at the moment, or what aspects of their life is causing them to be like that, and how can we address that and change that?
What got you interested in this in the first place?
Well, my mum's a healer and my sister's a chiropractor, so I guess it's in the family. And I got really interested in energy since about 13. Mum got me feeling the energy of trees, and I always thought it was a load of rubbish, really. And then when I was about 13, suddenly I was like, hey, there's something in this, Mum.
So you believed her then?
Yeah, okay. I felt it with my own hands.
Gosh. Right, so once you've administered your needles, what then do you look for when you take the pulse again?
You're really feeling how the person responds to those needles. So when you put a needle in someone, it's not just a physical needle like most people think. It has an energetic response. So energy comes down to that needle into that person and then affects the way the energy flows around their body. And when you feel the comeback to feeling the pulse, you can monitor how the person's energy is interacting with the energy which has just come into the needle. And that's really where it's very important, is looking at how they're responding to it. Because you can't just say, this person's going to respond like that, or this person can respond like that. It's a really unique thing. We're not really looking at what problem a person's got. It's what that problem is, what that person is, rather than what the problem is.
Right, okay. So that's quite sort of a homeopathic.
Yeah, it's a more holistic way of looking at the body, yeah.
So going back to the Chinese medicine, how did they sort of come up with the idea of putting needles into their body? Or did you not know that? I'm just quite interested about the history of it, really.
Mm. Well, it all kind of started off in big battles and things, really. They got a very good knowledge of the body anatomically through looking at bodies which had been mashed up on the battles. And they started noticing through massage, if they pressed on certain points, certain ailments got better. Mm-hmm. And it sort of built up from there, really. And then the first kind of point was like ashi, and ashi means ow. It's kind of like pressing a painful point. And they noticed pressing that painful point would take the symptoms away. And over thousands of years, they built up a theory around how it worked.
What's been one of your major successes?
I had one interesting lady a few years ago who was losing her hair very fast and had stopped menstruating on a regular occasion. Mm-hmm. And after three treatments, she actually noticed her hair starting to grow forward again, her hair thickening, there was less hair in the bed. And her menstruation cycle started coming back into normal, kicking back in.
Right.
And then other things like depression started getting better in her life. And it's all connected in one way in Chinese medicine.
So that must be really rewarding.
Mm, it's very, very good.
And you also do massage. Tell me about that.
Massage complements the acupuncture well. It works very much with the blood flow in the body and, again, the energy flow. And are really looking at the functioning of the muscles and the relationship between how the muscles work.
Which do you enjoy most, or are they both the same?
It's all the same kettle of fish, really, but the acupuncture is much more theoretically demanding and working with people on much deeper levels, which is more rewarding work, really.
And what did it feel like when you were training, putting needles into people? I know they're quite small needles, but what did it feel? Did you feel like nervous? You think, oh my God, what am I doing? Or how did that feel for you?
It was quite weird, actually, because you learn it for 2 years, and then it's only in the third year you actually put a needle in someone. So you've just got no idea how it's going to be.
It's like imagining these random oranges shoved to the sideline, or a poor, depressed, like, lemon saying, oh, my God, you just stabbed me. Right.
Yeah, a bit like mulled wine. Just stick them in there.
Right. So what are your ambitions for the future? What do you want to see from acupuncture?
Well, I'd really like to see an integration between Western and Eastern medicine once again in the profession. And a very, very interesting area in acupuncture, which used to be around a lot more, is when traditionally in China, when you were well, you'd pay your acupuncturist. And then if you were sick, you wouldn't pay them until you got better again.
Sounds like a plan.
So it's a different way of looking at the body, you know, much more preventatively and keeping people well rather than just treating people when they're sick. Mm-hmm. I think this is a very important and justified way of treating me. I'd really like to see that more.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me about the clinics you've got, contact details and the website, etc.?
So I work in two clinics in Bristol under the house clinic. So one's in Redland, it's Redland House Clinic, and one's in the city centre on Queen Charlotte Street. And then I work over in Surrey as well, working with a group of acupuncturists.
Right, and contact number if people want to book an appointment?
Contact number is 0117 942 0200.
And do you have a website?
Yep, the House Clinics.
Right.
www.thehouseclinics.co.uk.
You weren't too sure about that, but that's good. Well, I'd like to say thank you very much, William. I'll pass for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
That report was by Lisa Braden. It's time now for another instalment from Cider with Rosie, bridged especially for Dalek Radio by and read by Malcolm Grieve.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. In weather that was new to me and cold and loud with bullying winds, my mother disappeared to visit my father. This was a long way off, out of sight, and I don't remember her going, but suddenly there were only the girls in the house tumbling about with brooms and dishcloths, arguing, quarrelling, and putting us to bed at random. House and food had a new smell, and meals appeared like dismal conjuring tricks, cold, raw, black, with too much fire. Marjorie was breathless and everywhere. She was 14, with all the family in her care. My socks slipped down and stayed down. I went unwashed for long periods of time. Black leaves swept into the house and piled up in the corners. It rained, and the floors sweated, and washing filled all the lines in the kitchen and dripped sadly on one and all. But we ate, and the girls moved about in a giggling flurry, exhausted at their losing game. As the days went by, such a tide of muddles mounted in the house that I didn't know which room I was in. I lived free, grubbing outside in the mud till I was black as a badger, and my nose ran free, as unchecked as my feet. I sailed my boots down the drain, I cut up sheets for puttees, and marched like a soldier through the swamps of leaves. Sensing my chance, I wandered far, eating all manners of raw objects, coloured berries, twigs and grubs, sick every day, but with a sickness of which I was proud. All this time the sisters went through the house, darting upstairs and down, beset on all sides by the rain coming in, boys growing filthier, sheets scorching, saucepans burning and kettles boiling over. The doll's house became a madhouse, and the girls frail birds flying in a wind of chaos. Doth giggled helplessly, Phil wept among the vegetables, and Marjorie would say when the day was over, "I'd lie down and die, if there was a place to lie down in." I was not at all surprised when I heard of the end of the world. Everything pointed to it. The sky was low and whirling with black clouds. The wood roared night and day, stirring great seas of sound. One night we sat around the kitchen table cracking walnuts with the best brass candlestick, when Marjorie came in from the town. She was shining with rain and loaded with bread and buns. She was also very white. "The war's over," she said. "It's ended." "Never," said Dorothy. "They told me at the stores," said Marjorie, "and they were giving away prunes." She gave us a bagful, and we ate them raw. The girls got tea and talked about it, and I was sure it was the end of the world. All my life was the war, and the war was the world. Now the war was over, so the end of the world had come. It made no other sense to me. "Let's go out and see what's happening," said Doth. "You know we can't leave the kids," said Marge. So we went too. It was dark, and the gleaming roofs of the village echoed with the buzz of singing. We went hand in hand, through the rain, up the bank and down the street. A bonfire crackled in one of the gardens, and a woman jumped up and down in the light of it, red as a devil, a jug in her hand uttering cries that were not singing. All down the other gardens there were other bonfires too. And a man came up and kissed the girls and hopped in the road and twisted on one toe. Then he fell down in the mud and lay there working his legs like a frog and croaking a loud song. I wanted to stop. I'd never seen a man like this, in such a wild good humour. But we hurried on. We got to the pub and stared through the windows. The bar seemed on fire with its many lamps. Rose-coloured men through the rain-wet windows seemed to bulge and break into flame. They breathed out smoke, drank fire from golden jars, and I heard their great din with awe. Now anything might happen. And it did. A man rose up and crushed a glass like a nut between his hands and then held them out laughing for all to see his wounds. But the blood was lost in the general light of blood. Two other men came waltzing out of the door, locked in each other's arms. Fighting and cursing, they fell over the wall and rolled down the bank in the dark. There was a screaming woman we could not see. "Jimmy! Jimmy!" she wailed. "Oh, Jimmy! This'll kill him! I'll fetch the vicar, I will! Oh, Jimmy!" "Just hark at 'em," said Duff, shocked and delighted. "The kids ought to be in bed," said Marjorie. "Stop a minute longer. Only a minute. It won't do no harm." Then the schoolhouse chimney caught on fire. A fountain of sparks shot high into the night, writhing and sweeping on the wind, falling and dancing along the road. The chimney hissed like a firework. Great rockets of flame came gushing forth, emptying the tiny house, so I expected to see chairs and tables, knives and forks, radiant and burning, follow. The moss tiles smouldered with sulphurous soot. Yellow jets of smoke belched from cracks in the chimney. We stood in the rain and watched it entranced, as if the site had been saved for this day. As if the house had been saved, together with a year's bad litter, to be sent up in flames and rejoicing. How everyone bellowed and scuffled and sang, drunk with their beer and the sight of the fire. But what would happen now that the war was over? What would happen to my uncles who lived in it? Those huge, remote men who appeared suddenly at our house reeking of leather and horses. What would happen to our father, who was khakied like every other man, yet special, not like other men? His picture hung over the piano, trim, haughty, with a badged cap and a spiked moustache. I confused him with the Kaiser. Would he die now the war was over? As we gazed at the flaming schoolhouse chimney and smelt the burning throughout the valley, I knew something momentous was occurring. At any moment, I looked for a spectacular end to my already long life. Oh, the end of the war and the world. There was rain in my shoes and Mother had disappeared. I never expected to see another day.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Tony Gosling is poised to read us another chapter from the history of the theatre in Bristol.
The story of the Bristol stage, from 1490 to 1925, serialised in 9 parts from the book of the same name by Miss M. Board. Part 6, Bristol's Theatre as a Cooperative Institution. In 1881, the Shute brothers gave up the old theatre. They also opened refreshment rooms at the Prince's. This year marked another visit by Edward Compton. And on December the 5th, the Carla Rosa Company came again. On December the 12th, Henry Irving and Ellen Terry and the full Lyceum Company came. They played Charles I, The Merchant of Venice, and Tennyson's The Cup. Early doors were introduced, an innovation which made a tremendous difference to the poorer section of the audience. In the year 1882, Miss Genevieve Ward came in Forget Me Not. Miss Ward's father, who lived in Bristol, was Colonel Samuel Ward, the American consul, in 1858. His house stood on the ground where now stands the Colonial Institute. Miss Genevieve Ward was really the Countess de Kerabel. On August 4, 1884, the new Theatre Royal was renamed the Prince's Theatre. The other name caused confusion between the two theatres. This year brought Hugh Conway's play Called Back. Hugh Conway was born in Bristol on May 15, 1847. His real name was Frederick John Fargus. Fred Terry produced his play. J.L. Toole and his company came again. Mrs. Langtry came in a play written especially for her by W.G. Wills, called A Young Tramp. This year also introduced to Bristol the world-famous play The Private Secretary. A new stage was erected in 1886, and the first play upon its boards was Adam Bede, in which William Ringgold played. Cyril Maude and Wilson Barrett visited Bristol this year. To Mr. James Chute, it was a year of paramount importance, for on June 2nd he married, at the Pro-Cathedral, Miss Abigail Philomena Hennessy, the daughter of Mr. Joseph Hennessy. This step was equally good for the theatre and for himself. Mrs. James Chute had been one of the sweetest of our Bristol managers. She had assisted with the popularity of Prince's Theatre, and with her much-beloved husband has upheld the tone of both plays and players. Mr. and Mrs. Chute have inspired Bristolians with great affection, and the relationship between them and their public is most cordial. Indeed, Bristolians feel the stage is essentially part of their lives, and that theatres of our city are in a sense a cooperative arrangement in which both public and players and managers are equally interested. This is a living art and must produce effect. It is interesting to read that Miss Clara Butt sang at Mrs. Chute's at home at the Prince's Theatre. Miss Clara Butt also sang the national anthem and, by special request, the Lost Chord at Mr. J. M. Chute's annual benefit at the Prince's in the Diamond Jubilee year on Saturday, June the 26th, 1897. On August the 15th, 1888, George Chute died, a pathetic and untimely end to his career. From that date, his brother, James Chute, became sole manager. Mr. James Chute, unlike his brother, who was an actor, had been trained as a civil engineer and intended for India. As his health did not permit this plan to mature, he entered the office of the superintendent of one of the large railway companies. On September the 10th, he opened his management with Arthur Roberts, the Old Guard. Miss Sylvia Hudson also came this year to Bristol. The first pantomime he produced alone was Robinson Crusoe. The pantomime of 1890 was Cinderella, and 150,000 people saw it. This year, Miss Fanny Wentworth came to Bristol too. In 1891, Henry Irving and Ellen Terry again came to Bristol, and with them were Mr. Gordon Craig, Mr. Terrace, Alfred Bishop, Mr. Haviland and Amy Rossell. The play was Ravenswood. Frank Benson brought A Midsummer Night's Dream to Bristol in 1892. Beerbohm Tree brought Fred Terry, H. Kemble and others from the Haymarket in Peril. And John Hare came in A Quiet Rubber. September the 17th, 1894, Henry Irving, supported by Marion Terry, Annie Hughes and Genevieve Ward, appeared in Beckett. George Alexander with the St. James Company, Irene Vanberg, Evelyn Millard and Granville appeared in The Second Mrs. Tonqueray and The Masqueraders. Silas Ruthin came to Bristol this year, and The Divine Sarah produced in Bristol La Dame or Camellia. Wilson Barrett brought The Sign of the Cross in 1895. The immortal Penley brought A Little Ray of Sunshine, and Arthur Brushier came in 1896 with Violet and Irene Vanberg in The Chilly Widow in a flying matinee. Miss Eva Moore also came to Bristol. Arthur Holmes came in The Case of the Rebellious Susan. He was the son of Mr. Holmes Gore, the much-respected clerk to the magistrates for Bristol for many years. The son's career was cut short by the war. During this period came Mrs. Patrick Campbell, Gerald de Maurier, and Sullivan's opera The Emerald Isle. In 1902, the most beloved actor of our stage, Mr. Forbes Robertson, came to Bristol in The Light That Failed. Miss Marie Tempest came in The Marriage of Kitty. Miss Ada Reeves also was here. On June the 10th, Sir Henry Irving again came to Bristol, and he was present at a banquet given at his honour at the Century Club. The theatre was redecorated. Two shops were removed. The fauteuils were taken from the pit and a new drop act was painted by William Harford. The theatre was made much safer for the public in 1902. Sarah Bernhard was in Bristol on July the 15th. It was a grand year. Mr. Fred Terry and Miss Julia Nielsen came in Sunday. Ellen Terry in Alice Sit by the Fire, the play which Barry wrote for her. The pantomime was Mother Goose, and in it came Wilkie Bard, who with Horace Mills filled our youthful hearts. Those two men are immortalised in the love of children. Horace Mills came to the pantomime of 1906, and Zena Dare came in Peter Pan. One can imagine nothing more lasting than the memory of the acting of Mr. Forbes Robertson. As a child, I saw him play Hamlet. I can see him just now, as clearly as I saw him then, surrounded by an aureole of beauty and dignity that made an indelible impression upon the memory. One could not see Forbes Robertson without realising the sanctity of the stage, our holy art. In 1912, the Bristol Playgoers Club elected Messrs. J.M. Shute, A. Lorin Lothrop, and H. Slater Stone to become their first honorary members, and Mrs. Shute later as their first lady honorary member. James Shute, Bristol's beloved manager, died on February the 15th, 1912. His death deprived the Bristol stage of much. Mr. Shute had stood for all that's good in our theatrical life. At the time of his death, it was written of him, Mr. Shute has a reputation which is as wide as the theatre he so ably managed. Mr. Shute exercised severe censorship, and we are grateful to him, not only for what he showed us, but also that from which he has delivered us. It was good to find the records of James Shute that he was a member of the Michael Gunn Company Limited, who managed the Prince of Wales Theatre in Birmingham and the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin. This shows his love of art was not bounded by the walls of his own theatre. Shute is world famous for his wonderful pantomimes. He raised this form of entertainment to a very high level. His pantomimes delighted the mature members of the audience quite as much as the children. As a spectacle, they were beautiful. They were extremely witty. We shall always keep the memories of these pantomimes as some of our most delightful. On April 6, 1912, Mrs. James Shute and Mr. Hart, who'd assisted Mr. Shute in the management during his last illness, applied to the magistrates for the licence for the Prince's Theatre. The chairman, in granting the licence, said he and his colleagues wished to say how great was their pleasure that the name of Shute would still continue to be associated with the Prince's Theatre. Mr. Shute had conducted the theatre with such a consciousness of responsibility that could but excite grateful memories. Mr. Shute realised to an unusual degree his moral and artistic responsibility and never allowed himself to be wholly influenced simply by what the public wants. The Prince's was formed into a limited company on February the 15th, 1913, and known as Prince's Theatre Limited, Mr. George Davis being chairman. Ellis Miller was retained as general manager and treasurer. The press recorded, "The Prince's is more than a Bristol theatre. It is one of those famous English playhouses that have helped to make recorded theatrical history." The season under the new management opened on March the 4th with What Every Woman Knows, a week of Ibsen, and then The Count of Luxembourg. The Whip, that breathless drama from Drury Lane, came to be followed closely by the farewell visit of dear Forbes Robertson in The Light That Failed and other plays. That marvellous artist, Anna Pavlova, came with a full company of Russian dancers. We feel that something from the years before time has arrived with these dancers. Primitive is a word robbed of its meaning by continual use, yet these seem primeval. The spirit of motion unperceived, unknown, in the twilight of our beginnings animates them. That they are just men and women does not express the emotion their dance creates. We seem on the verge of a revelation of a beauty that's unknown, but not unperceived. They haunt our memory, as do primeval things. That was part six of The Story of the Bristol Stage, 1490 to 1925, by Miss M. Board. Next week, part seven, Bristol Theatre during World War I. The Avon Association of Drama covers the Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire areas, and publishes Prompt magazine today, 10 times a year. Every other activity includes festivals, playwriting, open air and touring productions, publicity and training. Individual membership and subscription to Prompt is £10 a year, and the Avon Association of Drama's website's at avondrama.co.uk. Mark Graves is subscription secretary. He can be reached on 01454 238 384.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, after an absence, Jeff's back with us again from his holidays, and he's going to tell us what's going on in Bristol, and afterwards he's going to read us two of his poems. Hello, Jeff.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Let's start off with Friday, 11th of July, and at the Carling Academy in Bristol, Stephen Marley will be performing. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 11th of July, and this time at the Cat and Wheel in Gloucester Road, Bristol, the Mutoids will be performing. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I decided to play something completely different. This is A Scooter with the track Jumping All Over the World from the album of the same name.
Encore, hardcore, rock you down to the floor, false desire.
That was a Scooter with Jumping All Over the World. For more information, you can check out www.scootertechno.com and www.myspace.com/scootertechno. Moving on to Saturday, 12th of July, and at the Park Adult Education Centre in Daventry Road in Knowle, Bristol. It's the WYSIWYGRC Second Bikes and Bands Day. The event features performances from the likes of Live Zeppelin, Storm Theory and Ye Gods. It starts at 12 noon and entry is £3 on the door. Now, there is an after-show event for the Bikes and Bands Day, and this is at the Albert Inn in West Street at Bristol. It starts at 8:30pm and is free entry and features a performance by Dead End Dolls. Finally, on Saturday 12th of July, fresh from their Gilfest performance, Alien Stash Tint will be performing at the Tavistock Inn in Tavistock, Devon. The gigs will start around 9pm and entry is free. Moving on to Sunday 13th of July, and at the Old Duke in King Street, Bristol, the Eddie Martin Band will be performing. Entry is free and the gigs will start around 9pm. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now I read you a poem which was written by J.R.R. Tolkien, who was born on 3rd of January 1892 in South Africa and died at the age of 81 in Bournemouth, England on 2nd of September 1973. He was a writer, a poet and a university professor. He is of course best known as the author of the works The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Here is one of his poems which is titled I Sit and Think. I sit beside the fire and think of all that I have seen, of meadows, meadow flowers and butterflies in summers that have been, of yellow leaves and gossamer in autumns that there were, with morning mist and silver sun and wind upon my hair. I sit beside the fire and think of how the world would be when winter comes without a spring that I shall never see. For still there are so many things that I have never seen. In every wood, in every spring, there is a different green. I sit beside the fire and think of people long ago, and people who will see a world that I shall never know. But all the while I sit and think of times there were before. I listen for returning feet and voices at the door.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show from the centre of Bristol, just by Queen Square. With us in the studio today was the usual Dalek team. Matt Heap interviewed our guest in the studio this week, Katie Alcott from Frank Walter. The actor Malcolm Grieve presented an apprentice chapter from Cider with Rosie, and the features were by reporters Lisa Braden and Anthea Page. What's On was brought to you by Jeff Sparks. Studio engineer was Phyllis Chichikuran. The show was sponsored by The Converging World, an organisation that uses profit from wind turbines to set up more turbines, and also to fund the work of established Indian sustainable development agencies. You can log on to their website to check them out at theconvergingworld.org, and that's all one word, or you can always email them at info@theconvergingworld.org. The presenter of this week's show was me, John Peters Coleman, and Matt Heap. The producer was Anthea Page.